welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the subtitle of this book is Lessons from an Unexpected Fatherhood. And while it sounds like the timing of becoming a dad might not have been ideal, was there ever any question about actually becoming a father for you?
You know, there really wasn't. I knew from a pretty early age, you know, that sounds a bit strange, but, you know, I knew growing up that I was going to one day have a family, right? I think that was just a part of my my way of thinking about myself. Given that my parents had divorced when I was 12, the question of what it means to have a family and the desires to be with a parent and children and whatnot were very much a part of my thinking as a teenager and as a young adult. I was not ready, though, for having kids when I had them. Both of them caught us off guard.
Well, and it's interesting because you said, you know, you knew from a fairly early age that you wanted to have a family. And that's kind of maybe an underrated part of the male growing up experience. The stereotype is that girls are thinking about this stuff far before boys
are. That's right.
Are.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I mean, for me, especially in my story, you know, having my parents split and my dad move away so quickly and so far away left me from a very early age, from the time I was 12, longing to be with my dad. And at a certain point, that just flips itself around where you think, you know, rather than longing to be with the dad, you start to think that one day I'll want to have children and this relationship will replicate itself. And, you know, the things that didn't get to happen when I was a kid will somehow be idealized by having children and being a dad. So that's how I've always kind of thought about having kids.
Is it oversimplifying things to talk about, you know, righting some wrongs or what might have in your mind have been wrongs?
Well, you know, not so much righting wrongs, but getting the chance to sort of have those experiences and have that kind of time and presence and consistency that I hadn't always gotten to have with my own dad.
Even so, you're right that you still were able to kind of maintain a pretty strong relationship as you could with your dad.
Well, that was the thing I was just going to say is that, you know, despite the distance between us, he and I have had, from the very beginning, a really close and intense relationship. And that was one of the best things of my growing up. You know, when we would spend time together, it was always really positive and also very intense and very connected time. I felt like I learned a lot from him, even though I had to learn those things in a compressed amount of time.
And sometimes over the phone next to a Dr. Pepper machine.
Oftentimes over the phone, you know. And in many ways, like the Dr. Pepper machine and the payphone is the kind of setup for the story, you know, that these lessons that I learned from my dad, I learned piecemeal. And I learned them through talking to him a few minutes at a time, a couple times a week. And so when I went to sort of think about how this book was going to get set up, I had that in the back of my mind, you know, these moments that you pay attention to yourself as a father or as a parent. And they started to seem like these sort of payphone conversations I was having with myself. And so that became the form that I used.
This is not your first memoir. Had you been kind of keeping track of life as a parent since it began?
So it's not my first memoir. It's my third book total. It's my second memoir. The previous memoir is A Door in the Ocean, and it came out in 2012. And that is in some ways a strange predecessor to this one because the story that one tells is far darker, and it's concerned with the loss of a close friend when I was in high school. When that book finished and I was coming out of it and looking for a new project, I started to think about, okay, what things are available to me right around my everyday and what things might be a break from this really heavy and violent story. And that was when I realized that I had these moments that I could draw out of fatherhood. And I really just started with one, and that one was the chapter in the book that's now called Heirlooms. It was published in Men's Health magazine under the title My Dad, Bad Santa. And it's about my father's really bad Christmas presents. You know, and if you can indulge it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you need to paint a picture of what some of these gifts are.
And, you know, people talk about their parents like not being good gift givers. You know, mine was bad in a whole other way, you know. For example, we would get every year like a sleeve of spaghetti and a jar of tomato sauce, or I'd get a cheese sampler. And one year he gave me a big sausage. I was always getting food. You know, I think that he and my stepmom were always sort of aghast at how much I was eating.
change from his ashtray.
Well, and the worst that it ever was he dumped his pickup truck's ashtray into a Ziploc baggie and wrapped it up and put it under the tree, and it was $17 and some number of cents that I unwrapped, you know, sitting by the tree with a cup of coffee on Saturday morning. And the funny thing about those presents is that they were always a kind of gag between us, and at the same time, there was always something kind of emotional about them. You know, I always thought, oh no, Christmas is going to really be a disappointment. However, the real thing with Christmas was that I didn't really want the presents in the first place. I just wanted more time. I just wanted to spend time with him, time by the ocean, which is where he lived, time just sort of hanging around. And in some ways, those presents seemed to understand that and kind of make fun of it all at the same time. And it struck me as I was sort of telling this funny story, which I just imagined as something funny, that the gift of time and presence is something I still long for with him, but it's also the thing that I can give to my own children, not only every Christmas, but in many ways every day.
It's funny because it seems like one of those cliches that you always read about, that, you know, the best gift that you can give your kids is time and presence. And in the case of this cliche, it really is true.
You know, it's as much as it is a cliche, it seems as though there's really no way around it, you know. The things that we get for birthdays and Christmases and big holidays and whatever are ultimately just material things that pass away. I think the same could probably be said with the ways in which we approach parenting in terms of thinking about advice that we dispense. You know, here's the thing you need to know about this. Here's the thing you need to know about that. Here's how you tie a tie, and here's how you start the lawnmower, and here's how you, you know, ask someone out on a date or something like that. What really ends up mattering, I think, is just that we're around each other. We spend time in each other's presence. We create spaces as parents and children, as fathers to sons, to have intimate and honest conversations. And so presence ultimately is the best possible present.
Let's get back for a second to that word unexpected.
Yeah.
What do you see as maybe the most unexpected or among the most unexpected aspects to fatherhood as you've experienced it?
That's a really great question. You know, I guess I would say I've always imagined myself as a kind of person of principle. You know, I think a lot. I think through my writing. I'd always thought that when I, you know, became a father, I would have these commitments and these ideals that I would somehow try to live by. And here are the things that I'm really connected to, you know, as a family, as a person, as a parent, as a whatever. And children seem like they are born knowing how to thwart your principles, your ideals, and your best intentions. They are endlessly moving targets. And that means that in most situations, and in many ways the book is sort of telling these stories again and again, we're presented with some kind of challenge. I think that I have a principle that's going to lead me through, and it never quite goes the right way the first time around. And I find myself having to back up, rethink it, and sort of, you know, change course in response to how the kids are trying to thwart my own expectations or my own good efforts or sort of get around whatever, you know, thing I've sort of put before them.
We should note that there is, in fact, a kid in the studio with us.
He's sitting right here beside me.
And he has not thwarted any part of this interview yet.
He's inching ever closer, though, as though he's about to speak into the microphone.
So I wonder if you have any concerns that a book like this puts your readers in the position of judging your parenting skills and your wife's parenting skills.
Yeah. You know, I don't think I have real concerns about how they're going to judge us. You know, one of the ways that a book like this works is that you just throw yourself out there and say, you know, and this is in some ways the conceit, you know, for everything that I was confronted with, I screwed it up the first time. And it turned out to be okay. By seeing the failure the first time around, I'm able to go back and learn it in a different way. And I'm sure that there are things that I do as a dad, whether intentionally or inadvertently, that people are going to really disagree with. And that's okay. You know, I think that it's more important to understand that most of us are trying to make it up as we go along. And there's probably the most joy and the most unexpected delight, as well as the unexpected moments of meaning and closeness and intimacy that happen when you have to improvise, you know. And I would guess that most parents are great improvisers.
Yeah, I try not to invoke books by other authors during interviews with authors, but there's a book just coming out by the writer Pamela Druckerman that is sitting on my to-be-read stack next to my bed, but it's called There Are No Grown-Ups. And I think part of the point it makes is that for most of us, adulthood is this kind of learn-as-you-go proposition.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that book, but I do think that that's a very true statement. You know, most of us are trying to do the best that we can. One of the things that interested me as I was sort of working on One Day You'll Thank Me is the way that American men or American fathers get portrayed in pop culture and in the media. You know, and if you think about it, especially think about the TV shows that feature dads as a sort of prominent part of the show, you often have the sort of heavy-handed, heavy-fisted, dictatorial father. And on the other hand, you have the sort of Phil Dunphy character. And I'm a great fan of Modern Family, but he in some ways is emblematic of that other side. You know, he's the constant playmate. He's kind of adult. You know, he's often sort of cruising for a kind of comeuppance or something, you know. And my experience talking to friends, talking to people, you know, sort of just in the course of life, tells me that most American fathers of whatever persuasion are somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. You know, few of any of us see ourselves as absolute sort of heavy-fisted dictators. And yet most of us see ourselves as taking the job seriously. You want to do right by your kids. And that means that, you know, when confronted with challenges, problems, whether they're funny or they become more serious, you don't want to just sort of wave it off or dismiss it. You don't want to overreact and you don't want to underreact. You're looking for that sort of Goldilocks happy medium. And I was trying to show that the mistakes lead you to that kind of you know, backwards wisdom, I guess.
It is a model of fatherhood that doesn't lend itself very well to the Father's Day cards you see at Walgreens.
Absolutely not. Yeah, absolutely not. And I didn't want it to be any kind of self-help book. You know, the other thing that you see with Father's Day books or father's books are survival guides, you know, the sort of sergeant's guide to surviving the first year of fatherhood or something. And again, I think that most parents don't just want to survive it. They want to thrive. They want to have a relationship with their children that is meaningful and rich and fun and funny and also sort of shows them the world for all of its complex beauty.
There is one other aspect of this book that I think will resonate especially strongly with your readers here, and that's beyond just the experiencing fatherhood through new eyes. You're also experiencing Wisconsin through new
that's
eyes.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
Can you talk about some of those adjustments?
I can. Yeah, and that's actually, you know, one of the sort of delights of the story for me. We came here in 2006 from Salt Lake City. I'd been teaching at the University of Utah. And we were 1,500 miles from our nearest family member. So we didn't know a soul. And we were, you know, 3 days' drive away from anybody that was connected to us. And our older son was just 2, and we were pregnant with our younger son. So we very much felt like we were an island unto ourselves. And when you're in that situation, you tend to pay really close attention to everything that's going on around you. So the first time I witnessed Appleton kind of shut down for a Packers game, which is not something I had ever seen before in my life, I was really struck by the intensity of Packer fever, you know, or going apple picking or a fish fry, you know. And one of the stories that I really loved, because it just happened so much this way, is when we went down to the Dickens Festival in Ripon, which is about an hour south of us. And we're sort of befuddled by the things that we found, including this really great display of Advent. What are they called? Nativity scenes.
Right, right.
Yeah, nativity scenes with these really hilarious but very local captions, you know. And that's not something that you see in the places where I had grown up. You know, Houston, Texas and Orange County, California are places where people have moved to and move away from because of the jobs. You know, you don't have these sort of long-standing, and you do in some small pockets, but you don't quite have.
It's a different institutional memory.
It's a very different kind of community memory. And seeing that in a place like Ripon, I found both strange, you know, and bizarre, but also really wonderful, you know. And I was just telling some friends yesterday that as time has gone on, I find myself longing for Wisconsin when I'm away from it. You know, the trees, the smell of the air, the Lake Michigan shoreline. It's amazing how a place becomes a part of you. And I think it became a part of me because, you know, my children have grown up here, and it's become so much a part of this sort of newness that I have found in so much of my other life. The landscape is a part of it.
Which might be another another unexpected aspect to
it. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and since I teach at, you know, a college, it means I'm constantly in conversation with young people who are on the verge of finishing a degree and going out to start a life. And they're always thinking about where they're going to do it. And because classes just ended, we were just having this conversation. And so-and-so wants to go to New York, and so-and-so wants to go to Chicago, and someone else wants to go overseas. And I've told them, you know, you never know how a place is going to get under your skin. And in many ways, you can't predict it. And that's exactly what happened to me. You know, I never would have guessed that Wisconsin would be a place that would get so under my skin. But by Lord, it really has.
Well, David McGlynn, thank you so much.
What
a great book and a great conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here.